Good morning. Now, apologies if there's a massive bang of Groundhog Day off this first bit of playback, because I'm afraid it's face mask time.
Where it began.
Months ago, Neil. Months ago.
I can't begin to know it.
Yes, the conversation that first started way, way back was still going on this week. Should we all be in a face mask? And if so, what kind? Sorry, just one sec. Thanks. As I said, deja vu. Damn the planet, go disposable. Maybe a pretty flowery fabric one, stylish, but what's that on the side? Is that a bit of snot? No hands, Neil. We've talked about this. Would your good Christmas scarf do the job? Or are we just overthinking this? What about a scrap of J-cloth boiled to bits? Or really, would only medical grade do? Frankly, your head would be melted.
Sweet Caroline, good times never seem so
that song there, because yes, you've heard that music before and in this context, but hell's bells, we needed something to keep you with us for this next bit, because it's quite the tangle. But let's start at the end of the week and work our way back. By Thursday, NEFID had met and decided face masks would not be mandatory, but they would start a public awareness campaign to encourage the public to wear masks in busy indoor settings and on public transport. On Friday morning, Dr. Tony Houlihan spoke to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland.
Your advice on face masks and coverings is very clear, that they should be worn on public transport and in confined settings like supermarkets, but most people aren't wearing them. What do you want to clarify this morning?
So the advice, as you say, is clear. It hasn't changed. It is in the settings you've said. For reasons that are, it can be difficult to sometimes maintain physical distancing on public transport and in indoor settings, particularly in retail settings. And that's why we've recommended them for use in those settings. But maybe we think the message hasn't fully gotten through, even though we've been clear. And so we think we want to now redouble our efforts, if you like, to communicate clearly to the public the importance of this particular measure. We've all seen from our own daily experience, I've seen it when I've been in my local Dunn stores. I wear a mask, but I can see that the majority of people are not wearing masks. And I think we see this as an important measure. We see it as an additional measure to all the other measures that we recommend. It doesn't replace the need for other things like hand washing and so on. But we think it's an important measure and we'd like to see a higher level of compliance in relation to it. And so we're going to be stepping up our communications and public information with some radio, television ads and so on over the course of the next period of time to emphasise for people the circumstances, how to wear them in such a way as to both to protect yourself and maybe some of the things to be aware of, that if you don't wear them properly, it can then paradoxically increase the risk of transmission of infection. We want to try and clarify all of that for people and how then people can go about making or providing for themselves an appropriate face covering that we think is appropriate for use in those settings.
Dr. Tony Houlihan on Morning Ireland yesterday, clear, he said, well, maybe by Friday, but for many, it was a long, torturous week getting there. Dr. Killian de Gascoigne, medical virologist and director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory, spoke to Sarah McInerney on Wednesday. It started well enough.
Our advice from NEFIT is that people should be wearing face masks in areas where they can't maintain physical distance. Because that's the thing, the face masks are, they're an add-on, they're a supplement. So they're not a magic shield, they're not going to prevent everything. But certainly where people can't remain physically distant from people. So the classic examples that we've been using are public transport or in retail. But if people are driving in their car, they don't need to wear a face mask. If people are walking out in the fresh air, they don't need to wear a face mask.
Well, that seems fairly straightforward, but no. Because when it came to what kind of face mask, well, there were a lot of variables. You see, Killian de Gascoigne had said that fabric face masks were not fantastic. But then the WHO envoy Dr. David Nabarro seemed to disagree.
Now there's been new evidence that's come through, strong evidence, that it suggests that actually fabric face coverings can be useful in, first of all, preventing a person who might have COVID in the early stages or even without symptoms from passing it on to others. And we've been particularly concerned that there are some individuals who, by virtue of their work, are in constant contact with lots of other people who seem to be at very high risk of getting the disease, who sometimes just do not have access to the necessary face masks. And we are saying, because of the possibility of asymptomatic people transferring COVID from one to the other, yes, we've got to also now recommend that fabric face protectors are also worn.
So where does that leave us?
So my understanding of what Dr. Navarro is saying is that the evidence is around asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic transmission. That's what he's talking about. So in that context, it means that previously we would have recommended masks for people who are symptomatic. So masks have been used long before COVID-19 and will be used long into the future. The two areas were for people who are symptomatic. So that would be for anybody with a respiratory tract infection. If they can tolerate a mask, they should be wearing a mask when they go into hospital to prevent onward transmission from somebody who is infected with something, be it influenza or another human coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2. Equally, masks are used by healthcare workers to protect themselves when they're providing care to people who are infected with respiratory viruses. So what we're talking about now is moving that out of the healthcare setting and into the community. Mm. And the evidence around masks in the community is, I probably shouldn't have used the word, it's not fantastic, but there's not a strong evidence base for it, purely because we don't have, a lot of the studies haven't been done. So certainly the studies haven't really been done with SARS-CoV-2 because it's a brand new virus. So we're extrapolating from other viruses like influenza, like other human coronaviruses. And we believe there is a role to play for masks or for cloth face coverings or for fabric face coverings, but it's only in the setting where physical distancing is not possible.
In a perhaps less than surprising revelation, medical grade face masks were the best.
So in an ideal world, if there was no problem over supply or cost, would you be recommending that everyone in the country, where possible, wears a medical grade face mask when they are in public settings where physical distancing can't be maintained?
In a situation where physical distancing can't be maintained and we think a face covering should be used, then a medical grade face mask, if available, would be preferable to homemade face masks or fabric cloth face masks.
Okay, so why has that not been recommended? Is it an issue over cost or is it an issue over supply? If that's the best medical advice you could give, why is that not being given?
So there are a number of considerations. To my knowledge, cost hasn't been a significant consideration. Available supply was a significant consideration a number of weeks back. There are other, I suppose, concerns in the broader setting. As we move to a situation where there's very little virus circulating in the community, if we send out lots of disposable face masks, there will be waste issues. We also have to be concerned about the appropriate utility of face masks in general. So because we know that if people don't use them appropriately, they can increase the risk. So if I'm wearing a face mask and I contaminate it, then I can contaminate my hands and I can contaminate surfaces. So they're not a magic shield. And we also want to ensure that people continue to practice good hand hygiene, respiratory etiquette and physical distancing. So if you can maintain physical distancing, then a face mask doesn't add additionally to your level of protection.
Nevertheless, there was still confusion. Here's one text into Sarah.
I'm more confused now than ever about face masks and coverings.
So once more with feeling.
In essence, where people can't maintain physical distance, they should be wearing a face covering. That's the message at this point.
Of any type, a scarf, of fabric.
So ideally, it needs to be something. So the problem with a scarf is that people may not wash the scarf sort of regularly. They'll take it home, they'll hang it on the hanger, and then they'll wear it again. So in essence, these things need to be single use. So for healthcare workers, they will use their face mask for prolonged periods of time. But as soon as a mask gets soiled or wet, it needs to be changed. So what we want people in the community to do is, if they're going to a shop, so if they're out in the open, they don't need a face mask. Unless they're symptomatic, but then they shouldn't be out in the open. That's a separate issue. So if people are going to the shop or if they're going on public transport, when they get there, they put on the mask, sanitize their hands, do their shopping. When they come back out in the open air or going back into their car, they take off their mask, pop it in a bag, sanitize their hands again, and then go off about their business.
And what do you do with your mask in the bag?
If it's someone that you've made at home, if it's cloth, you bring it home and then you wash it at 60 degrees.
Okay, and you can rewear it then. What if you're at the shop and you decide to have a drink of water and you pull down the mask? Can you pull it back up again?
Zero, what are you trying to do? A valid question, but really, we might scream.
So the problem is then you've ideally, in an ideal world, you would be changing your mask at that point. But in a in the community setting, that's going to be very difficult. See, this is one of the challenges around recommending universal mask use. So in the context of, if you put it down, have a drink of water, yes, you can pull it back up, sanitize your hands, use the same one, but ideally you don't want to be touching your mask once it's in place.
Dr. Killian de Gascoigne with Sarah McInerney on Wednesday. And later that same day, face masks were on the agenda for drive time. Barry Lenehan spoke to Dr. Luke O'Neill, and frankly, he seemed a little frustrated by the whole debate.
It's not that difficult, to be honest. I mean, the guidelines are, you wash your hands. Remember, you should be washing your hands anyway, regularly. So you wash your hands carefully, put the mask on, go to the supermarket, go on public transport. They're the places to wear them, by the way. It's not everywhere. And then when you come home, take the mask off and wash your hands again. That's the process. And then be sure to keep the mask clean. You know, the cloth masks, maybe every second day, give them a good wash in the washing machine or whatever it is. The more surgical masks, one use is all that you're allowed, really, with those ones, you know. But the cotton masks can be washed in the regular wash. So it isn't that difficult, I don't think.
But there seemed to be some confusion if you're out with your mask on and you want to take a sip of water and you touch your mask, that really you should be putting on a different mask.
I think as long as your hands are clean, remember, if you wash your hands, there's no virus on your hands now. And even if you're in a supermarket, you can use some of the hand sanitizer. Your hands are now clean, and then you can lift the mask up, take a sip of water, put the mask back on, and off you go.
Professor Luke O'Neill on Wednesday's Drive Time. And just after that, Mary Wilson spoke to Dr. April Bowler from the WHO Health Emergencies Programme.
To stay with these fabric masks, some people are buying masks now to match their outfits. Some people are wearing scarves around their mouths. Some people, of course, not wearing anything at all. But what is the WHO advice on these face coverings?
Right now, there's research which has come out, which was requested by WHO to Stanford University, Colorado, and also some other universities. And really, it was to try to answer that question, because we didn't have the evidence before. And what has really what's come out is that there's different types of material, ranging from polypropylene to cotton to nylon. And all of these have different levels of barrier, the called filtration efficiency, but basically it provides a barrier. So depending on which material is used, it provides a different barrier level. The challenge is that there can be a high barrier level, but then because of the way that it's woven, then there can be a challenge with breathability, because the tighter it's woven, the more difficult it can become to breathe. So you have to have something which is both provides that barrier, but at the same time can be used so people can walk around and talk.
Okay, so both breathable and a barrier. Gotcha. Back to Mary.
Is any face covering subject to proper hand hygiene involved? Is any face covering better than no face covering at all when it comes to situations where you can't physically distance, where you can't socially distance?
So it's a good question. It depends what the purpose of the mask is, if it's prevention or if it's for source control. So the fabric mask, based on the evidence that's available, it provides a certain level of barrier, but as source control. In other words, if I wear it and I'm sick, then I prevent somebody else getting sick. However, if I'm using it for prevention, which is now something which is being recommended with respect to vulnerable populations or 60 years and older, we don't have the evidence for that. So if it's for source control, then you know, depending on the material, yes, it can provide a barrier. What we don't know is the level of barrier that's required to prevent the transmission of the virus, of the COVID virus. So this is why we can only, the point right now is to share the information, the evidence that's available, and to update that as soon as we have more and more clarity as we move forward. But this, as mentioned before, is very new science. And even though it's important for everyone to be informed, we also have to know that it's still in the, it's still in the early stages.
Dr. April Bowler on Wednesday's Drive Time, and you can see why this has been a tricky one. No easy answers. But we'll end on Professor Luke O'Neill, who was on with Sarah McInerney yesterday.
The Chief Medical Officer, Tony Houlihan, was on Morning Ireland earlier, and he said the message around masks has been very clear. Do you think the advice has been clear?
No, it hasn't been cleared. I mean, early April, many countries began to make masks mandatory, right? And making strong recommendations. We weren't doing that at the time. Now, they began to do it, to give them credit, give Tony credit. I mean, the science was a bit plus minus about 3 months ago, sir, in truth. You know, there was good evidence, but it got better and better and better. I'd say the turning point for me was probably about 10 weeks ago. It became crystal clear to me this is the thing to do. But no, the messaging has got clearer and we got to keep, and you've noticed it. I mean, it's going to get much clearer in the coming days.
And if in doubt,
you got to put your mask where your mouth is.
And it's over. Breathe. Back in a bit. Welcome back. There was all kinds of nostalgia knocking around the radio this week. Ryan returned and spoke to John O'Regan, the producer behind Reeling in the Years, and he ran at breakneck speed to summarise the last decade. Deep breath.
Okay, it's very near top of the list. It's going to be Katie Taylor, London Olympics. You've got the bailout in 2010, the Troika coming in. You've got that referendum, the same-sex marriage, marriage equality, the rainbow banner at Dublin Castle. You've got Brexit, remember Brexit. You've got love-hate on the telly starting in 2010, wow. Mrs Brown's Boys. You've got the Me Too movement. You've got Black Lives Matter. You've got Garth Brooks coming to play Croke Park, yeah, or not. You've got the commemorations for 1916 and 2016. You've got people like Maurice McCabe. You've got Emma McMahona. You've got Hozier. You've got Codaline. You've got Imelda May. You've got Dermot Kennedy. You've got Nathan Carter, Wagon Wheel. You've got Rubber Bandits. You've got the Pope coming to Ireland, Savita Halappanavar. The water charges protests. You've got, remember, the World Cup final with the women's hockey, Ireland in that.
Yeah.
Theresa Mannion, don't make unnecessary journeys. You've got the O'Donovan brothers of the Rio Olympics, pulled like a dog. You've got Kilkenny hurling, because you've always got Kilkenny hurling. You've got Shane Lowry winning the British Open. You've got Young Offenders on television. Do you remember the Ice Bucket Challenge?
Yeah, of course.
And do you remember Pokemon Go? You've got the Beast from the East. You've got Steve Jobs.
Crikey.
You've got the migration crisis in the Mediterranean. You have the civil war in Syria. You have, well, I could just keep going. So it's all a jumble. The task is to sort all that into something that you can go, oh yeah, yeah. Oh, do you remember that? Yeah, across half an hour, which is the ideal viewing experience.
Exactly. As we like to say, good luck with that.
Whew, John O'Regan from Reeling in the Years. Was that all only really 10 years ago? And if that's taking you right back, what about this?
And if you want it, come and get it, crying out loud. The love that I was giving you never in doubt. Let go of your heart, let go of your head, and feel it now. Let go of your heart, let go of your head, and feel it now. Babylon.
Babylon from the 1998 album White Ladder by David Gray, an album that was the soundtrack to many Irish lives in the late 90s. And to mark a documentary on Ireland's love affair with the man himself, Ray Darcy spoke to Gray about the album, which one listener described thus.
That White Ladder album was just like a bottle of flat 7-Up in an Irish household. It would cure any ailment. So it's a good thing. That's a good thing, David. I know it doesn't sound good, but it's a good thing.
Oh, that's a very Irish text. Well, David Gray talked about his father breaking out of hospital to see him play Glastonbury when Burt Bacharach dropped out.
You know, one cocktail too many and it was a no-show from Burt, you know. The cravat, he couldn't get the matching cravat and jacket that they'd left it back in London, no-show. So Bacharach was out, Gray was in. What a day that was. I think that my dad had watched that gig. The first gig was televised a bit. He'd seen some of the highlights of us playing on the TV, and obviously that was just like agony watching it from his hospital bed. And then once the news broke that we were going to be playing again, he obviously just said, "Right, well, sod this. I'm not missing this."
Yeah.
And I think he just pulled the tubes out and got his mate to pick him up in the car park, and they legged it and they basically blagged into Glastonbury. But it was like that, not just for him turning up, which was the craziest moment of all. It was just people were coming out of the woodwork, you know, left, right and centre. There was a massive tribe of us. It was like everybody knew this was it. It was actually happening. And it was so emotional.
David Gray's father had cancer. So when he spotted someone backstage, he wasn't going to hold back.
So you, him, and I don't know who else is there, but David Bowie is there.
Yeah, that was amazing. It was just the yet another amazing thing that happened at that time. We got off stage and he saw Bowie just standing outside his porter cabin with his security guard sort of, you know, guarding him. And he just said, look at us, surrounded by all our family and friends, having the time of our lives. And look at him over there. He just looks lost. You know what? I'm going to go and speak to him. And I said, hang on a second. You know, you can blag into the backstage area, but going over to speak to David Bowie, you're pushing this too far. But my dad wasn't having any of it. He had that kind of mad look in his eye because he knew he only had a few months left, I guess. And off he went, and we went with him. We tagged along, me, Clune and Tim. And the next thing, we were chatting with Bowie, and it wasn't like a five-minute thing where Bowie gives the nod and the security step in and bye-bye. You know, it was like... It went on for a good hour. We were just chatting and chatting away. Then he took me into his dressing room, showed me his song list and asked me what I thought and, you know, told us all about his first Glastonbury. And he obviously really loved seeing the thing that was there in us that he'd been through himself. Yeah. I don't think it all just unfolded by magic for David Bowie. He had to work his way into what he was. And it's just that thing of seeing that look in people's eyes, that feeling that he knows there's no better feeling, and he saw it in us. It was an incredible day. I mean, really, the day that Babylon went into the charts in the UK. So it was a good day, a day of days.
David Gray with Ray Darcy. On Liveline, Joe continued to explore the racism seemingly bred in our bones here. It was a conversation that had started last week, and unfortunately, there was no shortage of people of all ages and backgrounds with stories of abuse and discrimination, stories of everyday casual comments and other incidents more aggressive and even violent. Here's Brendan.
Brendan, did a day go by without...
Never. The 60s, 70s, early to mid-60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000... Even a man was mentioning about the buses. When I was in Artane getting the 42A and the 42B back to Artane, I might be on my own. And you just run off the bus, you'd be in tears, you'd be just so afraid. Fear, because the biggest fear was that if you were attacked, nobody would come to your aid. Nobody. You'd be kicked to death, which has happened to me several times. You'd be left for dead on the street, but nobody would come to your aid. And that was the killing part. Yeah. They would be watching and looking at you, and you get up and you'd be covered in blood. It just happened to me, as I said, many times. And nobody would lift a finger to help you.
Brendan on Monday. On Tuesday, Franz from Dingle phoned in.
Like, I work in a shop here in Dingle, and just a lot of people come in asking so many questions about why I'm black and stuff, and they just start off by asking where I'm from, where I was born and stuff, and I say that I'm Irish, I'm from Kerry, I was born in Tralee Hospital, I've lived in Dingle all my life, and they just keep pushing and pushing to find out why I'm black, like, and not white, and then I tell them my mother's from Ghana, so that's where I get my colour from, like, but they just keep pushing to get that answer out of me.
But it was an encounter on the GAA pitch that truly shocked.
And you're a good Ga player, I see.
Yeah, I kick a bit of ball, all right.
Well, who isn't in Kerry, but...
You're kind of forced into it, right, from a young age. But, I would have experienced a few incidents on the pitch as well. There was one that really stands out to me. It was when, under-16s, we would have been playing away, and I wasn't actually even playing. I was doing water boy because I was injured, and I ran on with a bit of water to give to one of my teammates.
Okay.
And his marker looked over to me and shouted at him, "Go back to your cotton fields." And he laughed at himself, as if it was a big joke. Like, but it didn't really affect me. It didn't really hit me then. I just kind of let the game play out. I didn't really think much of it. But when I got home then, I got a text off one of their players. He was umpire that day. And he said he reported it to the referee, and the referee will do whatever. So your man got a bit of a ban.
Franz on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, Jean Marie rang in. She's originally from Dublin, but now living in New Jersey.
Well, the first time it happened, I was in the States, and somebody said, "What are they?" And they looked at my children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, usually I would say, depending on what way it's said, I would say they're half Irish, they're half black. And I just say it like that. But this time I was in Ireland, and I was in a store, and an older gentleman was kind of kept looking at me in the store, and I was like, what is, you know, and it's one thing I love about Ireland, just complete strangers come up and they talk to you. Yeah, and, but this just felt a little off, and he pointed, and I thought he was pointing at something on the shelf, and he said, what are they? And I had my both kids with me, and I was trying to, you know, keep them entertained. And I said, excuse me. And he pointed at the kids and he said, what are they? And I said, they're humans, because I was just so taken aback. And I didn't even tell my own family about this because, you know, it happens all of the time. You know, it happens in the States, you know, this is the only experience I've had in Ireland where it's happened. You know, a lot of times people will say, are they yours? Are they yours? They'll say that about me. My children don't look like me. Yeah. You know, I'm white. I have red hair, freckles. You know, some people are genuinely curious. You know, they'll say, because my children don't have Afro hair, you know, they can, they look Spanish. They can look Middle Eastern. They look half Indian. So sometimes people are genuinely curious. But I think it was the way it was said that I was taken aback.
And this is the kind of conversation she's having with her children.
My son is 8, and we would have been having this conversation with him anyway, Joe, when he was around 13 or 14. We would have been having the talk, which means when you see a police officer, don't have anything in your hands. Don't look them in the eye, say yes or no, sir. Get into the back of the car, get the handcuffs on you. Do not answer back. Get arrested. Mommy and daddy will come pick you up from jail. That's a little bit of the talk that black parents would be having with their black children or brown children.
Jean Marie on Wednesday. But it was perhaps Phil on Monday's Liveline who best encapsulated the grinding, corrosive effect of racism.
I know we're constantly talking about name-calling and we're constantly talking about these types of attacks, you know, and these things have an impact on your day. They have an impact on whether you want to get out of bed, whether you want to go to work, whether you want to go to school. And they have an impact on how you behave when you get there, you know. So people can often find you surly or aggressive or complain that you're always angry. But they don't understand what's happened between leaving your house and getting there. You know, they don't understand the gamut of abuse that maybe you've taken the night before or what's been said to your child. You know, that wears you down on a day-to-day basis. You know, that you have to shove down and people say, you know, well, ignore us. And I suppose this is one of the things that I was told as a child. Ignore. Nobody would ever, or at least didn't seem to have the language to articulate racism. What they would say was if somebody called you names or somebody did something, the first thing they said was ignore us. Ignore it, they're ignorant. Ignore it, they're stupid. Ignore it, they're jealous. Whatever it was. But you had to ignore it, so it became your problem.
Yeah, good point.
You know, it was always ignore us. You know, just ignore us. But nobody ever dealt with it. Nobody named it. Nobody claimed us. So you internalize it to the point that you become paralyzed. You're the one that stops going out. And by the time I got to sixth year in school, I had virtually stopped going to school. You know, so I failed the Leaving Cert. But then that was my problem. What was wrong with me? Why wasn't I working? You know, I was lazy.
Phil on Liveline. This Tuesday is Bloomsday.
Dusk and the shadows falling o'er land and sea.
Fat Five via Donato Bramante at dawn, standing on your writing table with stately plump Buck Mulligan shaving the morning air. There, in Trieste, overlooking a northerly Dublin bay at 8 a.m. June 16th, 1904. The day you and Nora first walked out together. It was Gold Cup Day at Ascot, while in New York, the General Slocum blew up in the East River and 500 lives were lost. And Dublin? Well, Cleary's summer sale was on, the pubs were open, There were births and deaths. There was much to be done. There was nothing to be done. There were rules to be broken and order to be kept. Soldiers in the city, drink. The prostitutes were busy. Business as usual. And Trieste. Uneasy, given the gathering war clouds, people began leaving the city. But you stayed in the Martello Tower with a sullen Stephen Dedalus, away from the war, wiping his brow. Europe burned around you. Until June 27th, 1915, when you boarded a train for Zurich. Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls.
From City of Words by Bernard Clark on Lyric FM. And you can wash down the Gorgonzola with the whole smorgasbord of Ulysses treats here on the radio. So no excuses not to get your bloom on. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Mooney Goes Wild, blackbirds were the focus. Although they're not very well named because some are brown and some, it seems, are white. Here's Terry Flanagan with Professor Nicola Marples of Trinity College.
There are very few pure albinos.
There are very few pure albinos, but that's natural selection again. That's your evolution happening. Yeah. The predators see them so much more easily. Than
now, when
a predator
sees a white blackbird, is he not put off and say, oh, I don't like the look of this one?
Well, actually, relating to the dietary conservatism story, yes, absolutely. It's been shown by a fantastic guy called Gottmark, who did a whole load of really interesting studies, actually before I discovered dietary conservatism and called it that. He was saying he wondered whether funny-looking prey was less attractive to goshawks, and he was working on goshawks choosing their prey. So he painted the wings of a whole load of blackbirds and put them out, dead ones, put them out for his goshawks to choose, and they avoided all the funny coloured ones and ate all the normal coloured ones. So yes, indeed, it may be that the white ones get away with survival slightly better than you might expect because the predators are not sure what they are. But on the other hand, they can see them really well, so they'll probably manage to pick them off anyway. And the ACs amongst them will definitely pick them off.
But if you did survive, what would be your chances of reproducing? Turns out blackbirds will have their head turned for a good singer.
They're usually choosing their partners more on song than they are on vision. So it could be that as long as he sings really well, he may get away with it. She may be able to think, OK, he's a bit weird, but never mind. Yeah, but he sings so beautifully.
She's listening to him, to his song, because if he's got a good song, he's got good genes. He's the guy that I want to father my children.
Absolutely.
But do I want my children to be white?
Well, see, she may be a little bit too simplistic about this and not think that one through. Because let's face it, she's a blackbird. So
She's actually a brown bird.
But most of the birds effectively use shortcuts to, we call them rules of thumb. Because they have to keep their brains quite small, they have to take shortcuts in their thinking. And so they tend to work by what called rules of thumb, little rules that mean that they don't have to process so much information. And with mate choice, quite often, now I don't know if it's the case in blackbirds, but I suspect it is because they sing so well and so lengthily, that the female chooses just on one criterion, and it's likely to be song in blackbirds. So just because he looks a bit weird probably won't put her off too much. But it would be interesting to look at a study and see whether the ones with white on them find it harder to get mates than the ones that are properly black.
She's probably thinking, he's a good-looking guy. He's got a weird hairstyle, but look, I can change.
But I can, yeah, that's right. I'll train him. I'll train him out of it.
Terry Flanagan with Professor Nicola Marples of Trinity College Dublin on Mooney Goes Wild. Now, from Vogue magazine to fashion TV, André Léon Talley is a man for whom the word fabulous might just have been coined. His memoir is called The Chiffon Trenches, and he spoke to Kay Sheehy on Arena.
You were blessed to have two strong female role models very early on in your life, your grandmother who raised you, and then the former Vogue editor, Diana Vreeland, who gave you your first career break. How would you describe their influence?
Both women were very much similar, but they were from different, opposite sides of the world. Mrs. Vreeland was a white woman of a very elitist world, and privileged world, brought up and raised, born in Paris, was a Vogue editor, a bizarre editor for 28 years before she became a Vogue editor. My grandmother was a domestic maid, but in their similarities to me were they believed in the same values: discipline, honor, decency, empathy towards your other fellow mankind, passion, curiosity, and they believed in maintenance. Maintenance was next to cleanliness. Cleanliness was next to godliness, and you maintained everything. Mrs. Vreeland polished the soles of her shoes with a rhinoceros horn. Well, she didn't polish them herself. She had an assistant polish them. My grandmother had me polish the floors of our house with Johnson's paste wax and a cloth. So everything was pristine, polished. Polish is a discipline. When military people polish their boots, when they shine their boots, how needed they pack their kits. All of this was a value about discipline, maintenance, and just having great good values about being. And this is what they both had in common.
And what about editor-in-chief of US Vogue, Anna Wintour? Famously chilly, the rays of that eyebrow could make or break you. But she and André had gotten on very well. Until, of course, they didn't. But first, the good times.
How did you negotiate that difficult personality over the years?
Well, I simply respected her and respected her patterns of work. Quick. Lunch is quick. You go to lunch. You bite into your drumstick. Let's go. You've ordered two courses. You just had the first course, a mouthful of salad. You've got to chew it, get up and go back to the office. Decisions are made quickly. You know what she knows. She knows what she wants. She does not have meetings that last 40 minutes. Meetings that last 12 minutes. And you've got to be on your feet thinking fast. And it was a wonderful time. It was just a great, 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 great time over the decades.
Great, great times until this happened.
This is the moment when she somehow kicked me to the curb by throwing me off the red carpet at the Met Gala during the live chats, interviews of the celebrities, and no explanation was given. And I just thought, well, this is it. I've been thrown to the curb. I'm too old. Maybe I'm too fat. And I'm of no use to her. She has since wished me well. And she does not see this book. She does not remember the book as I remember it. But I wish her well. I wish her no ill. I think she's still a great editor. She's a vibrant force in the world of fashion. And she's a woman of power. She's the czarina of all fashion.
André on Anna Wintour, a woman who could probably end you for just eating an eclair. But André wasn't above a little bit of name-dropping. He'd worked for Andy Warhol at the factory and partied at Studio 54. Mind your tippy toes.
I must say that at Studio 54 was the moment in the 70s. I was there the night it opened and I was there the night it closed. There has never been, nor will there ever be. You cannot replicate Studio 54. Everybody who was anyone went through the doors of 54. I was there dancing with Diana Ross on New Year's Eve in December 1979, I think. Cher, Bianca Jagger rode in on a white horse for one of her birthday celebrations and a Halston slip dress. Truman Capote, the great society lionesses were there. CZ Guest, the great society horsewoman. Deanna Reel, of course. Liza Minnelli, Martha Graham. Everyone, Justin Trudeau, everyone stopped at 54. It was a great place, and it was very much like a utopia because it was just the world melted into one big, great moment of dance. You could be a young boy like me with a job in Women's Wear Daily, or you could be a waiter aspiring to become something, wearing little boxer shorts, running around serving drinks.
Ooh, what a discotastic image that was. André Léon Talley with Kay Sheehy on Arena. Now to the quiz. A staple of daytime radio, and every so often, radio gold.
Let's say hello to Thomas Boyce. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you. How are you getting on?
Not a bother, not a bother.
This is a cliff-based quiz, Thomas.
Yes.
Are you ready?
Yeah, we'll have a go at it.
Okay, what do you call a man with a seagull on his head?
A man with a seagull on his head?
Yeah. Now, remember what sort of a based quiz this is.
I'm a seagull on his head.
Yep.
Cliff.
Oh, yeah. Cliff. Yeah, that's it. You said it.
Cliff.
Seagull head. It's a joke. Okay, I'm going to play you a song that that features a famous cliff, okay?
Okay.
I want the name of this. Are you, have you anyone with you there, Thomas? Are you on your own?
No.
Okay, could be a long morning. So here we go, though. I just need you to give me the name of the singer.
Not
Clifford T. Ward, but the singer's a woman.
Oh, God. I know the woman.
Shares a name with a former president of America and his dad, who was also former president of America.
Not Nixon, no.
Because Nixon's dad wasn't president. So
No, I know.
The president after Reagan and... he was Reagan's
voice. He was on the 9/11.
Yes. Come on. It sounds like shrubbery. Not the name, but it sounds like a piece of garden, like something you see in the garden.
Oh, God.
Or whiskey. Is there anyone... You know, for Jesus.
Help! My wife is roaring.
She's roaring. I heard her, and I'm not in your house. No, ask her again. I can't give you the answer.
Hold on.
How can you not hear her?
I don't know. I can't hear
her. Would you ask her to come up, or is she... Can she?
Hold on. Just give me 2 seconds. I'll come up the stairs.
I think the singer of the song... What?
Kate Bush.
Yeah, do you know what? It is absolutely Kate Bush. Amazing. I have aged 2 years. Man yourself. Not quite a cliff, but bear with me. The 60-foot sculptures of the heads of US presidents Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt and Lincoln feature in the which South Dakota National Monument? Mount something.
Mount. Oh, God.
Rhymes with slush for. When you're in a hurry, you're in a
panic.
Ask the wife.
Mount Rushmore.
What small rodents have become the subject of a wildly popular misconception that they are driven to commit mass suicide when they migrate by jumping off cliffs? Rhymes with Hemmings. Yeah. Take out the H and put an L instead of Hemmings.
Lemmings.
Daniel Radcliffe's most famous role was as which young bespectacled wizard? Sounds like Larry Cotter. What's that?
Rush. Oh, sorry.
He's a little wizard. He's a wizard. It rhymes with Larry Cotter.
Potter. No.
Yeah. Congratulations, you've won the trip. Well done. Just see where you go. Have a great time, Thomas.
Oh, live on the radio, it's not always easy. Well, that's it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. I'm not here next week, but talk to you the week after.
Well, they never won't let me clap on my hands. Clap on my hands.